Welcome to another edition of Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to smash the taboo of talking about death and dying. And today I'm very pleased to be joined by Toby Porter, who's the CEO of Hospice UK. And we're recording this in time for Dying Matters Awareness Week, which I see from your website, Toby, is exactly about what I'm about here, isn't it, really? It's to do with smashing the stigma around talking about death and dying. Why don't we talk about it enough?
Well, it has become a profound act of societal self-harm in terms of the way that we're losing our ability to talk about death, to plan death, to see death as a social event rather than as a sort of medical catastrophe. It wasn't always this way. And I think that despite our wonderful advances in medical science, the way in which we think about and support everyday dying has clearly gone backwards. And I think it is causing harm in our society, you know, and in particular harm caused to people just before and at their moment of death, many of whom go through cycles or moments of intense medical treatment that really have no purpose but can be highly invasive and difficult. And obviously harm for the bereaved who perhaps have come too late to the realization and the understanding that their loved one was dying, and may have their natural grieving process further complicated by a feeling that it just wasn't done right. So podcasts like yours, I think, are enormously important in helping people talk about death and understand about death and dying. And obviously it's something Hospice UK has been very proud to be involved with as part of our Dying Matters Week. And this year, as you say, has also a focus on equity and making sure that the steps that we take as a country, as a society, to improve conversations about death and dying also factor in how different cultures and different communities, the different ways in which people think about death and talk about death.
I've done quite a few episodes. I've spoken to a Jewish rabbi and a Muslim and a Sikh and a Christian priest, and it's fascinating, the differences. But I kind of get the impression from what you're saying that you're saying we don't prepare ourselves or each other, or even somebody who's approaching death very well?
I think not always. I'll give you an example just from someone who I knew and respected very much. But I was a student at Oxford College down the road here as an undergraduate, and 56 years old, I suppose every 3 or 4 years, my year group gets invited back for a dinner. There was a lovely head of development, Simon, and I remember an email went round just a few days before the dinner, and it said that he was extremely ill with cancer and was receiving hospice care. And then the college came up with what was a lovely idea, which says, as you go up the stairways into the dining hall, there's a massive card, because it would be wonderful for Simon to know how many friends and admirers he had in the college alumni community, which he did, because he was fantastic person. And I was one of the last to go into the hall because I'd been talking with friends outside. Obviously, working in palliative care in the hospice sector, what I noticed was, you know, when I came and saw all of these messages, you know, it was things like get well soon, look forward to seeing you back at work, you know, etc. And the college couldn't have been clearer, you know, seriously ill with cancer and receiving receiving hospice care. And these messages, which were lovely messages, and they all came from the heart and from the best place. But they were left by captains of industry, lawyers, you know,
intelligent people.
the some of the best educated and the most successful people in the UK. And yet something when you're confronted with just a sad fact that the, you know, much loved contact point in the alumni community in the development office was dying. Very few people in that group seem to be able to say, I don't know, but if I was receiving that card, I suppose what I would want to, they're not quite the messages that I'd
No.
want to see. I'd want to see go well, you
Do you
know.
remember what you wrote?
I just said, I hope that you're receiving the you and your loved ones are receiving the care and the support you need, and you should be feel very proud of just how much affection and respect there is for you across the college community for the person you are. Yes, I do remember what I wrote.
It's really interesting what you raise, because most often I think when you hear the word hospice, you do think it somebody's really at the very end, and it kind of sets up a bit of fear in us, I think. But you're saying all those people were just in denial.
Well, that remains the biggest challenge of the hospice sector, Dilys, as you know from your work at Thames Hospice. So the word hospice does strike fear into people, and people who haven't seen hospice care from the inside or seen a friend or a relative receiving hospice care do associate hospice care with absolute end of life care, and therefore see the early referral to hospice care as absolutely at odds with where they may be on their journey with their disease or with their condition. And so, you know, as you know, the imagery is I'm going to beat this, I'm going to win my fight, I'm stronger than this disease, etc. So you can see that if that is people's understandable, entirely justifiable attitude at the start of their illness, that people can access hospice care very late. So you know that you'll get so many testimonies, and you know, I always love when I visit a hospice, look going to the nursing station and seeing the cards that they have that they've received from families of people who've been helped by the hospice. And so many times it's phrases like, I wish we'd come earlier. I can't believe we never knew about how wonderful this place is until just before mum or dad died, or just before my husband, my wife passed away. And this is also true. I worked, had the privilege of working for 6 years for a wonderful children's hospice in Birmingham called Acorns. And Acorns, you know, the families who access children's hospice care are obviously some of the most vulnerable cohort of families in our society, but also some of the most remarkable and resilient and capable and amazing. And essentially, their whole, these parents, because in the end it does come down to parents with kids, their whole lives are based around keeping their kids alive and meeting their exceptionally complex health needs. And actually, most children's hospice care has nothing to do with end of life care. It's all about respite and building resilience and therapies and play and magic and creating special memories and acting as a channel with all the sort of remarkable compassion and goodness that exists in a community towards seriously ill children, and acting as a channel for that generosity. You know, so forever people saying, I'm a Ferrari dealer, so take it, would some of the kids like to come and have a drive in a Ferrari, or have a day in the box at Aston Villa, or watch the cricket at Edgbaston, and just this sort of constant kindness. And so many families miss out on this because they're scared about the associations with hospice, the word hospice. But you know, you'll know this. I think that hospice, it was a Greek word originally, hospice, HOSPIS, and it meant a place of rest. And you know, that's a very sort of profound concept with many dimensions, if you like, that I think accurately fits. And actually, one of the reasons why people in the hospice community that some of the people who are concerned about how assisted dying might impact is, it's not so much, you know, the all views in society around assisted dying are also found in the hospice sector, and there isn't a single view, and I certainly wouldn't attempt to give one. But what is true is that this critical work around public perception is that if people think already today, in a country where assisted dying is absolutely not legal, people who haven't seen hospice care from the inside say and joke, "Oh, I don't want to go to the hospice because I'll get bumped off." Yeah. And this already acts as a big barrier for us to get early people in early to the care service, where it can have so much more impact. And we're worried that if there is assisted dying, that make it harder still, because people will say, "Well, I'm really not going now," you know, because I'm worried about it. Which, of course, is nonsense, huh? And the people who are proposing a change in the law aren't proposing this in any negative or coercive way. But it's all about that public perception.
Have you any statistics about how many people go into hospices for help along the way rather than end-of-life care?
I mean, the statistics I have, so the average client is known to a children's hospice, I think, for 10 or 11 years.
Oh, really? As long
Right?
as
So
that.
that's I think, a lovely statistic.
Yeah. So a lot of help can be given
There's a lot of help
over
can be
that
given.
time.
And actually, that's, again, it, probably contrary to public perception. The majority of children receiving hospice care don't have cancer, for example. They have complex health conditions for which there is no cure, and profound disability often associated with those conditions. But their actual health deteriorates very slowly. And with the medical advances, you are able to not only keep them alive, but these kids go to school, they have joy, they have fulfilling family lives and stuff. So, and then I suppose another statistic is that 300,000 people every year are believed to be on the books of hospices. But the number of people who die in hospices would only number in the tens of thousands. So there's a statistic. So there's an absolute lack of correlation between receiving hospice care and dying in a hospice. The numbers who receive hospice care was very, very much higher. And that's because hospice care is a concept, a philosophy, a process. And you might have someone who has received hospice care for 2 years, therapies, support groups, art clubs, outings, pre-bereavement counselling, practical advice, but they then may die suddenly, they may die in hospital, they may decide to die at home. And so I think that the most impressive stat, so we have in the UK this year, about 660,000 people will be expected to die, and the hospices help 300,000 a year. But that doesn't mean that 300,000 people are dying in hospices, but it just shows you how the reach of this wonderful charitable sector.
And you've mentioned so graphically there some of the wonderful things that can be done. But also people can die at home with hospice care help, can't they?
More
So
and more,
that's
and I think that's really where the sector is going.
is it?
So there are two things we're trying to do simultaneously, which is, I suppose, increase further the already high levels of clinical excellence and specialism in the inpatient units, because what we're finding as a sector is that hospitals are more and more referring their most complex patients out of hospitals and into the inpatient units of the hospices, because that's where they can receive the most complex care. So the one time in your inpatient unit, you're building up this specialist capability and becoming more and more clinically expert. But at the same time, we're trying to support more and more work in people's homes, because I think that's where society is really evolving. A lot of people want to die at home, but not everyone wants to die at home. I think the great mistake we often make in society and in planning health and social care is always assuming, particularly when new not trends, but people's things like the importance of dying at home. Lots of people understand it now better than they did, say, 10 years ago. But there'll always be exceptions. I think the mistake we make is suddenly we get a new idea and we think, well, everyone should do it like this or everyone should do it like that. And the reality is, and this is where I think the hospice sector is such a fragile but such a precious jewel in the UK's health and social care system, is that actually you need both. You need more beds, specialist beds in the community, in the hospices, in their units, but also you need more care delivered at accessible to people who are dying at home, and obviously in a difficult financial environment. Too many hospices at the moment are having to make a choice to say, well, do I cut beds in my hospice or do I cut back on the services at home? And actually, that's just a disaster because demand is growing every year. You know the statistics about so I told you just a moment ago that 660,000 people will die this year, plus or minus, in the UK. In 2040, that number will have risen gradually every year to 790,000. So we're just at the moment working with the NHS to try and ensure palliative and end-of-life care is a priority for the next 10-year plan, which is kind of like the big planning framework that we have in this country for our health service, and that's expected to be published in June. Well, over the period of this next 10-year plan, so June 25 to May 35, we can expect 7 million people to die in the UK. But from 2015 to 2025, so the 10-year plan just ending, that number's only 6 million. So there'll be an extra million deaths over the next period, which is a lot, huh? A lot. And going back to what you asked me at the beginning of the interview, the implications for getting that wrong are so profound. And I think that's what all of the end-of-life experts are just terrified about at the moment, is thinking, oh, what are we going to do with all of these extra people? It comes from baby boomers, this wonderful cohort of people who were born in the post-war period. And we've watched this population bulge, if you like, coming through their life course. And now they're all aged, what, 75? Whatever, lots of them in fantastic health because, the boomers have lived over this unprecedented era of growing life expectancy, medical advances, good pensions, low house prices, foreign holidays, etc. But sadly, no generation, even this one, can live forever. And now you've got this big, big bulge of population approaching the end of their life. And I recently lost my mother. She died in January, and she died in hospital here in Oxford. So I actually spent 2 days in the John Radcliffe Hospital because she was admitted with pneumonia. So hospital was the right place for her. Ordinarily, if she'd asked us, she'd say, I'd be happy to die at home. But, she was obviously hoping not to die of the pneumonia that got her. So hospital was definitely the right place, and she received good care there. But it meant I spent 2 nights and 2 days inside the A&E unit, basically. And I work in this sector. Not a day goes by where I'm not reading a report or writing an email that talks about the extra numbers of older people in the society and the serious implications for our entire health and care system if we don't deliver more care in the community. And people just come to A&E because there's no other place where they can get help. And I was, I would leave mum's room at 1 in the morning or 3 in the morning and go for a quick walk in the car park or go down the corridor to make a cup of coffee. And you could see it. It was like a war zone hospital, but all of the soldiers were over 85. It's absolutely staggering. I think any politician and any hospice leadership team and anyone in the social care services and people running district nurses, we should all be mandated to go and volunteer, I don't know, one night a month in a hospital, A&E, and be left the next morning with the challenge about how are you going to make this situation better? How are you going to deliver more care in the community so these beautiful, dignified older people don't have to come into A&E and lie on in corridors and in conditions of minimal dignity and humanity, if you like, because there's no care closer to home and stuff. Some of them need to be in hospital, but a lot of them could be well treated at home if we just had the services.
I have to throw this back at you. You're presumably in touch with politicians today. What do you say to them about it? What do they say back to you?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. So I think we are having some success. So I think that, the Cabinet Minister Wes Streeting, the Care Minister Stephen Kinnock, genuinely show real appreciation of the importance of palliative care. I think they will have been briefed as incoming politicians about, how is our health and care system working? And anybody who works in health and care knows what an issue, what they call last year of life hospital admissions are having on the capacity of the entire health system. So I think we're bringing them solutions more than problems, which is support good palliative care in the community, and you'll have less people coming into hospital. And if you, there has to be a solution there, Dilys, because we can't carry on with our aging population just treating people at the most expensive part of our health system, which is the hospital admission, unplanned.
So you think you're in quite a good position of influencing them over that,
Well, I'd
but
never be complacent. I mean, you're only as good as the next document or the next plan. But
or the next minister.
so far, I would say judge this government by its actions. The only charity sector supported at scale by this government so far financially, because all charities are finding life tough at the moment, has been the hospice sector. The government announced £100 million of new funding for hospices.
Did you have to do a lot of arm twisting?
About a year's worth of work 24/7, but it delivered a
It
result,
worked.
and I think the we were very pleased that the new government feels so good about that when they published their, I think, first 6 month report card. I think quite rightly they listed on their top 10 achievements a major package of funding for the financially embattled UK hospice sector. So congratulations to them. They should be proud.
So that must have made you feel good, but I dare say you'll tell me it wasn't enough.
No, I think if you're working on frontline service delivery or in your chosen expertise of building awareness and building our death literacy as a nation, you never rest on your laurels. You know, it's a life's work, isn't it? It's a generational thing. Again, the society's changed, so without any sense of whether I personally think assisted dying should or shouldn't be legal, I can see dispassionately and objectively that the assisted dying debate has created conditions where politicians are more interested in palliative care. And the reason for that is because people quite rightly have been challenged to say, surely, if assisted dying is going to be legal, we've got to have really good palliative care because the worst possible practical and moral outcome for a state would be one where someone might have wanted to carry on living, but felt that they couldn't get good pain relief or other symptom control. That would be a devastating failure, a shaming failure. So I think what you've seen is that the debates on assisted dying, that whether the MPs are for or against it, they all have been one after another saying we need better palliative care. So that has made me very optimistic in that sense.
You referenced the baby boomer generation before, and I owe not to be being one of those. And I think we've
Well, I wasn't going to say that. I think people should self-categorize
yes,
in that
but I've always been
glorious
pleased because we
generation.
have had the most wonderful lives, haven't we? We've been at the head of the curve and everything, really, and it's been great.
Yeah, but
And
you
I
did
think,
have to lose a lot of your parents and see
well,
your
that's
nations
true.
destroyed in the Second World War,
Yeah,
so it
that's
wasn't all
true.
plain sailing. Yeah.
No, but a lot of us have benefited very well from it. But now we want our own way with our death and our dying too, don't we?
I think there's an element. I see you as a generation that, you've challenged the conventions and the taboos as you've gone through your life course. And I think there is definitely an element of that in terms of I think the demands for there's rightly a lot of focus on protecting the most vulnerable members of our community if there was a change in the law, and pointing out the tremendous inequalities that exist in access to health services throughout the life course, including end of life. But I think in reality, the loudest and the strongest voices for change have actually come from more privileged members of our society. There's a certain ambiguity there, which I think we all just have to live with.
Well, we've always known how to make our voices
Yeah,
heard, I suppose, haven't
quiet.
we? Again, because we felt we've had that sort of power along over the years.
Yeah, and that process in the end, by the way, finds probably its most obvious articulation or manifestation in how significant Dame Esther Anson personally was in terms of galvanizing Keir Starmer into moving so quickly in his time as Prime Minister to create the conditions for the private members bill to be tabled so early.
Now, you mentioned your mother's death earlier on. Do you mind telling me more about that? Because
No,
it,
no.
was it
I think it's good for, well, it's not good for me, but I think it's important that people who work in the end of life sector are able to talk about their own experiences. It doesn't oblige me, but it would clearly be remiss of me, I think, to not be prepared to talk about my own experience, if you like, because it relates so directly to the mission. But my mum, she died in January, aged 81. She was my sole parent since I was 16. So my dad died actually on my 16th birthday,
Oh,
and received
very
very good
young.
hospice care from the lovely Dorothy House Hospice in Bath. And for the last 6 or 7 years, mum had moved to Oxford to be with us. So she was very much part of our daily life as well. It's not just a big emotional hole, but she was absolutely living part of our family, and her, my wife, our three kids, and her, we were kind of just a single family unit here. And she hadn't been aging particularly successfully. I'd say she, that mentally she was an incredibly young 81, and physically she was probably going on 90. But that's just the way it can be. So I had a sense that this was where things were going, and since November she'd been very poorly and was falling more, and the enjoyment had gone. I think she was ready. Certainly lots of people under lots of circumstances talk about a person, if you like, deciding for themselves when they start to let go. That's not true for everyone, and I would never be stupid or insensitive enough to say that this is a sort of general rule of life when so many people are sort of desperate to carry on living against the diseases they get. But in Mum's case, it was just frailty, really. And then, she was admitted to hospital. I was working in London that day. I'd seen her in the morning. I'd seen her actually in the middle of the night because she'd needed some help getting back into bed. So she'd given us a call. But she was, there was nothing to suggest that she was on anywhere on an end of life trajectory. And even when she was admitted with low sats, you know, blood oxygen, I just assumed that it would be another one of those long nights at A&E, and we'd be sat nattering on the uncomfortable formica chairs. And eventually she'd be hooked up to some rusting old oxygen tank and sit there for a few hours and be right as rain, and I'd take her home at, you know, 4 a.m. or something. So I got to hospital, and the consultant took me to one side and started talking in a very indirect way. So I actually said, look, I work in the hospice sector, I'm not a clinician, but just be honest. And then she said, your mum's, this, look at this chest x-ray, this is pneumonia, and she's not going home. So that was great. That's why we need, by the way, going back to your very first question, this is what we need our doctors to be
Yeah,
telling.
to be honest.
Because as a result of that honest conversation, and as well as some amazing courage from my mum, she actually held on. So that was on a Thursday night, and she only died on Saturday lunchtime. And Friday was the most wonderful day for all of her. For her, all of her grandchildren came, some of her best friends came, my late father's brother's family came, you know, everyone who was most important in her life came and said goodbye. And I know my children, you know, it gives all of us, it really was a good death. You know, she saw, she had time alone, she was very poorly, she had the sort of strong nasal flow through her nose, oxygen. But she absolutely knew where she was. She could hold conversations.
And she knew she was dying.
She knew she was
Did you
dying.
tell her that?
I did more or less, yeah.
Was that hard?
Well, no, we were so close. It would just seem fine because she was. So, you know, but yeah, it was, and then so we had all of this wonderful Friday, in still in recess actually, where she was taken, you know, when she had a pneumonia. So it was a quiet night on recess, and they were very good. You know, the palliative care team came round quite soon, and she was comfortable. So it was a good death, and we all take comfort from that. And also in her case, and as I say, I realize this is absolutely not the case for everyone, it's an enormous comfort now to know that she was ready. It's what she wanted. You know, she, her last few months, she had a carer, Malembe, who used to go around to her house for her flat for 2 or 3 hours a day and help her up in the morning. And after she died, you know, Malembe messaged to say not a day would go by where my mum wouldn't say to her, you know, I'm ready to die now, I've loved my life. But it wasn't in a negative way. It was like, I've loved my life, I love seeing the family, but I'm ready. So all of that was good, and
That's
that helps
comfort.
us a lot. And obviously, you know, it is hard. You know, it is hard. I know enough about bereavement, I think, that I am suffering a normal but very profound grieving process, but not outside the tram lines of, and into what I would say is complex grief. Yeah? I'm functioning in my work life, I'm functioning in my home life and stuff, but yeah, it's first few months were very busy. Mum rented a flat. There was a lot of work to do to give the flat back, empty everything. You know, we couldn't wait because it was rented and stuff. And then there was the funeral. And actually, so where are we now? The end of April. So she died really 3 months ago. And it was last week. It was the first time I took, with Easter, I thought, well, I'll take 5 days off and, you know, give myself an 8 day break. That would definitely be the hardest week I've had, actually, I think, in this whole time. And that's normal too, isn't it? People say coming in waves. But you if you work and if you're privileged to work in the charity sector, in the care sector, and you have that platform to make a difference, you have to use and try and channel your own personal experience into increasing your motivation for better, in this case, for better deaths for everyone. Because we had most of the boxes ticked. Mum had a good death. She said goodbye to everyone. She received good care. We had loving relationships beforehand. She was close to me, to my brother, to the family. So all those big boxes were ticked. And yet it still leaves a great big bloody hole, and that can leave you feeling blue. And but there are so many people who don't have those good experiences. I'm currently sitting on as one of the commissioners on the Commission of End of Life Care that was set up by parliamentarians to report to Wes Streeting and to Parliament actually in the coming weeks. And again, it was all brought about by the assisted dying bill and all of the debate around the state of palliative care. So the idea was to have a commission that would report back on palliative care and how. And just yesterday, actually, we commissioners heard from about six or seven remarkable individuals who were all of whom they were all in different geographies, and what they had in common is that they had all witnessed a loved one, a spouse, a parent, receive care that was of such bad quality that they have become campaigners, if you like. And on the one hand, I was really admiring their passion and their determination that the system learns lessons from the failures that they saw their loved ones experience. But I also felt, because I'm grieving myself, I just kept thinking, as this, must have such an impact on them to have had an experience so negative that they're still campaigning in, 6, 7 years, 3 years, 4 years later. I mean, it's admirable, but there's a side to you that just compassionate, you think, what toll that must have. Still feeling you haven't got closure in that sense. And, it's for real what we were talking about 10 minutes ago. As a country, we've got to get ready for, in 15 years' time, 150,000 people will die more every year than die today. And there are already people dying in corridors and falling through cracks and everything else. And if we get that wrong, then, well, every death, they talk about there being sort of four or five people who are very, very deeply affected, isn't it, in terms of close bereavement, siblings, parents, kids, etc. So you think about it, 600, 700,000 people's well-being, resilience, perhaps even their economic productivity depends on us doing a better job with end-of-life care. And like I said, this is what we need to treat it as a, if not a national emergency, but as a national call to arms to really put in place that care in the community. It's very, very difficult. It's very, very complicated.
With the aim being that everyone has a good death.
Best possible death. I think this is not an area where you're going to get to 100.0%. You'll have your accidents, you'll have your circumstances that are just so tragic that an individual and their loved ones can never reconcile. I mean, one thinks of children or young parents, parents of young children, they can still have a good death. But I think in the end, you have to recognize that some loss is just so utterly tragic that you're going to have to play a very long game. What I see every time I go around a hospice, I'm always so sad to see it, but you can see that sort of huddle of teenager, you know, who's probably taking time out, sitting in the cafe for a few minutes. You know it when you recognize. I've been one, huh? I was one. I was that child. And it's just so sad because there's so many of them now. I think those circumstances, you know, you can, for all of our talk and ambition for a good death for all, you have to also understand that some circumstances are just so awful.
Can I wrap it up by asking you a sort of double barrel question, which is obviously the loss of your mother was recent and fairly raw, but would you say your experience in the hospice sector has helped you with your grief? And on the other hand, would you say your experience with your mother is going to influence the way forward for you?
Well, good question. I mean, I think the first one is partially. So I work for a very compassionate employer. So Hospice UK, we spend a lot of time. We actually have a program called the Compassionate Employers Program. That's a sort of standard charity program where you what you say to a company is, look, you need to be able to support your colleagues when they're bereaved and get them to understand the impact of bereavement. You know, we all know the horror stories of people being called by their managers 2 or 3 days after the loss of a child, and when you're coming back to work, or I know you're on compassionate leave, but this sales pitch, would you mind just coming in, and you know, all of this. So we have a program ourselves that support employers, and obviously in order to do that, you have to make sure you're a very supportive employer yourself. So, you know, I took my compassionate leave allocation. I acknowledged, chief executive, but I put a message out on the Teams group, you know, for the charity. You know, my mum's just died, so I'll be working some days, not working on others, just as while I'm on compassionate leave, because I decided to take it not in a group, but days here and days there, based on what was happening. I may not be myself, and it's fine to ask me how I am, because grief knows no hierarchy, I think was the phrase I used. So I'm surrounded by very kind, experienced, and good people at work, which I think is a great asset. But sometimes, if you're in the trades, you might be slow, a bit slow to. My eldest daughter just the other day was saying, look, here's a website to cruise bereavement care. You've got the wonderful Sobel House Hospice in Oxford here. You know, I haven't accessed any bereavement support through that, and I think maybe I've actually been a bit slow. So I was thinking I might enroll myself. And then the second part of your question about inspiration, definitely, Mum has always been an inspiration for me, and I've always been proud that she was proud of my career in the charity sector, and she was always very supportive and indeed very generous personally to the charities I worked, Oxfam, Save the Children, Acorns, now Hospice UK. And I think what I said to you earlier about is obviously made me want to do more about to ensure that as many people as possible are supported to die well, and their loved ones are supported to see their relative or their partner or their friend die well. But I think there is a specific, because my mum was older when she died, 81, and quite frail, where it's really galvanized me is thinking about how we just all have to roll up our sleeves and think about what we do about this population wave over the next 15 years. Because, like I say, I work in this area, and I was still quite shocked just to see the reality of so many older women, older men arriving in hospital. And, you know, for all of the best efforts of the staff there, just dreadful conditions. And we all, that's, I think, where I'm really most motivated at the moment. What can hospices do about that?
I feel I should ask to come back in 10 years, see how you're getting on.
That would be nice, yeah.
Thank you, Toby
No,
Porter,
thank
ever
you.
so much for
Yeah.
talking to me.
It's been
Thank you.
really nice to talk about it. Talk about mum. Thank you.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.